From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The authors of a new book about the LDS Church in American politics say there's a Mormon paradox at play. On one hand, Mormons want to be distinctive, different. But on the other, they want to be seen as part of the group, as American as apple pie. So throughout the story of Mormonism, leaders have tried to find the right balance. And this tension is often reflected in politics. Today in the program, the scholars David Campbell and Quinn Monson are joining us to talk about their study of LDS political behavior. Some of this won't surprise you. Mormons are mostly conservative, big whoop. But a lot of this has to do with the level of a person's Mormonness and the messages they get from their leaders and their relationship with people who are not Mormon. The book is called Seeking the Promised Land. We'll talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So here's a question you often hear when you're talking about Mormonism and politics in America. Just what effect did Mitt Romney's religion have on his losing run for the presidency? That's a question that gets at Americans' attitude of Mormons. But what if you turned that question around some and asked, what effect did Mitt Romney's run for the presidency have on the LDS Church? That's a more nuanced question that seems to better get at the relationship between the church and politics because it explores the effects of politics on the religious mission of the church. And politics may be one of the best ways to explore what David Campbell and Quinn Monson see as the Mormon paradox, the church trying to be part of the American mainstream, but still be different, distinctive, peculiar is the term that Mormons embrace. Campbell and Monson have done an exhaustive study of LDS political behavior, and they're here today to talk about it. Their book, co-authored by John C. Green, is Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics. And we invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. David Campbell is a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame and the founding director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy. He's also the co-author of the book American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. He joined us a few years ago to talk about that one, and David Campbell is here, and welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Quinn Monson back with us, an associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University, as well as a senior scholar at the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy. He's written for a number of academic journals, regularly contributes to the blog Utah Data Points. David Campbell, and welcome to you, by the way, Quinn Monson.
Glad to be here again.
I'll point out that both of them are going to be... We should point out they're both Mormon, by the way, as well. That's good disclosure. But their book was published by Cambridge University Press. David Campbell's in Utah to give a lecture tonight at the University of Utah. He's also going to be speaking at BYU tomorrow, and we'll give you all of the details about that a little bit later on in the program. Okay, so let me begin, I guess, with a fairly broad question. What got you started on this subject? What was the thing you were trying to get at? Well, I mean, there's a lot to get at, but anything in particular?
It's hard to pinpoint when this started, except that I think we've been thinking about it for a long time. Dave and I knew each other as undergraduates years ago, and I think we've reconstructed that the plan for this project was hatched at some point in the student center at BYU over maybe a taco or something.
That's exactly what it was. We were sitting in the Cougar Eat. We were both seniors in political science on our way to graduate school, and we said, one day let's write a book about Mormons and American politics, but let's wait until we get tenure. And that's almost exactly how it unfolded, actually. So here it is. Now it's happened.
Do you think there's an essential misunderstanding about the relationship between religion and Mormonism? I mean, again, we'll dig into this in particular, but are there some basic myths out there you wanted to kind of get at and deal with?
I don't think there was a lot out there to go on in terms of scholarly work. I mean, there's an article or a book here or there, but none of them had the kind of data and analysis that we aspired to. And so to the extent that we're undertaking to shatter myths, I think some of that is maybe the kind of myth and folklore that swirls around in Mormon culture that I think we're both aware of. But other than that, in terms of the scholarly literature, not much out there.
Yeah, it's remarkable that there are roughly as many Mormons in America as there are Jews, and yet there is a vast literature, both in social science and in other academic disciplines, on American Judaism, and a tiny fraction of that on American Mormonism. And of what has been written about Mormons is mostly historical, so not as much contemporary work. And so to the extent that we were hoping to shatter illusions or maybe break down some myths, is we wanted to scratch below the surface, yeah, beyond the national caricature of Mormons as this monolithically conservative group that marches in lockstep with church leaders. And it's true, they're conservative, and yes, they do follow their leaders, but there's a lot more nuance there than maybe the public image would typically suggest.
There's a framework I think we have to understand to get at the essence of what you're going for here, and it's this idea of something that you call the sacred tabernacle as a way to kind of help understand how Latter-day Saints differentiate themselves from, you know, mainstream secular society. This idea of a sacred tabernacle. Quinn Monson, what is that?
Well, I think it's easiest to describe it in a way that contrasts with some other terms that we introduced. So one of them is this term called the sacred canopy a creation of a sociologist that talks about the sort of all-encompassing way that in a place like Western Europe, for example, that religion permeates the society historically. And if you think about Catholicism in Western Europe, for example, that might be a way to think about the fact that it is sort of a part of the whole society's life and encompasses everything. And then the other way to think about it is to think about the writing of a scholar, a colleague of Dave's at Notre Dame, Chris Smith, who writes about the sacred umbrella that American evangelicals in particular use to interact with the broader culture and sort of shield themselves and create space for themselves to be a part of the culture but still be religious. And when you think about those two things and then think about the sacred tabernacle, we've borrowed that language, that religious language from the Old Testament,
yep,
and used it in a way to describe Mormons, because Mormons have this way of shielding themselves from the broader culture, but it's done as a group. It's done in a community, and it relates to what I think is some of the essence of Mormon theology and doctrine that we get into a little bit in the book, that is essentially Mormons believe that we do this together. And it's not an individual thing. You don't shield yourself individually. And that permeates everything that we talk about in the book.
There's an argument you make that on some, you mentioned Judaism, Jewish culture. You make this case that religions can be seen as this ethno-religious group as well. Because they're so tight-knit, they become a kind of quasi-ethnicity in some way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The word ethnicity, just what exactly that means, is quite contested among academics. But most people would say that ethnicity requires some sort of genetic connection to a group. And that's why, even though we describe Mormons as quasi-ethnic, ethnic-esque, you can't quite go so far as to say they are truly an ethnic group, because you can be a convert to Mormonism in a way that you cannot be a convert to other ethnicities and nationalities and such. But we chose those words carefully, ethnic-like, ethnic-esque, or in a common phrase, Mormons are a people, because they have many, many characteristics that frankly make them look like an ethnic group. Now, you know, way back in the 1800s, it was believed that Mormons actually physically looked different than everyone else.
That's the horns maybe, and things.
The horns,
yeah,
and such. That's maybe not so true today. But if you just look at the way Mormons react when you ask questions about their sense of identity, they look a lot like other groups that we do clearly identify as ethnic, like African Americans or Latinos, for example. And in some respects, even more so. This is a group that really does have a sense of peoplehood or togetherness.
And that even when you convert to Mormonism, you begin to adopt some of those, some of that terminology, some of that sense of peoplehood, and with time, you clearly become a part of the group.
But then there's this contrasting idea, and I think this gets at a really major theme in the book. This is this Mormon paradox. So on one hand, Mormons want to be in the world, but not of it. They want to be a part. They want to be distinctive. But then the other part is they want to, or have come to want to be mainstream, assimilated. So that's the paradox, I guess. And they've adopted, one of the things you write about in the book is that they've adopted these different strategies to deal with the paradox. And the first one was, and this was in the early days of Mormonism, at first they decided to separate. Talk about what was important about that experience, the early day of Mormonism, because it seems that was important to this idea of tying them together as a social group. Because you say this brought with it the benefit of a high internal vitality for the faith, because we were it's us against the world, right? Is that it?
Well, you know, we're sitting here right today in a state that was founded by those early Mormons who came because they were, you know, escaping the persecution they'd faced in the Midwest, what we now call the Midwest. And in doing so, and essentially separating themselves off from the rest of American society, that's where I would argue that the peoplehood, the ethnicness, really began to take root within Mormonism, because not only was Mormonism cut off theologically, because you had church leaders here developing Mormon theology all that time, but they were also cut off politically. They were cut off economically. They really did have to survive on their own. And, you know, some aspects of that independence continue today within Mormonism. It kind of reverberates historically through the culture. And I think it's clear that that was a time of high internal vitality because church leaders emphasized how Mormons were different from the rest of America. And frankly, the rest of America made it clear how Mormons were different from them.
Right.
And today you do find those same emphases on distinction. It's just much more subtle because you don't have the geographic isolation anymore. You know, that ended in the 20th century, really.
Well, then came the other part. So there was separation for a while. They tried that. Didn't work so well in many ways, just being apart. I mean, wasn't practical as the country began to grow, of course. But so what they tried is, and you write about it in the beginning of the 20th century, is they pursue this new strategy. Let's assimilate. Let's be part of the world. And you say what happened was that Mormonism came to be integrated, and then this sacred tabernacle became less encompassing, and this is how you put it, but more portable. What do you mean?
I think we mean that part of it is, if you look at the history, the church stops what's known as the gathering. They stop asking people to gather to Zion and to come to Utah and allow them to stay where they are and build the church where they are. And that's where it becomes portable, and that's where this assimilation kind of comes from. And it's also an allowance that occurs because the church has given up polygamy, which was the major distinguishing factor, the major impediment in the time to any kind of interaction. I mean, that was such a dramatic break from American societal norms that it was necessary to be out in the middle of the West and on their own in order to do it. But once that was given up, then you could even start to even think about engaging the larger culture
and society. And it's important to note, because when we look at Mormonism today, this may seem strange, but at the early part of the 20th century, there really was an effort among at least some church leaders to mute, that is, sort of tamp down much of the distinctiveness of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. You know, and it appeared for a time in the early part of the 20th century, sort of pre-World War II, that, you know, maybe Mormonism would come to look a lot like a mainline Protestant denomination. But of course, that's not what happened, because that re-emphasis on distinction came and those lines of tension re-emerged. And we would argue that's sort of what has led to the sense of peoplehood, the internal vitality that you find today within Mormonism.
Is that the currency in some ways? The power of Mormonism is that sense of distinctiveness? That's the thing that creates this community, is this idea that we are...
The internal vitality is a way of saying this is what makes it a good thing to be a Mormon. You have access to this community, and it's you have friends, you have a social network, and at the same time it makes it difficult because you're different, and in some circles you're looked on with suspicion, right? So that's the essence of the paradox.
So this gets us to this idea of of how this translates politically. One of the things you write about is the different types of Mormons, or the different types of Mormonness. And I wanted you to sort of explain a little bit about this, because you kind of break it down into the particular categories. One of them is the degree of religious practice, the degree to which someone is so-called active. Another one is the idea of authority, the degree to which they feel a sense of obedience to church leaders. Is that essentially
it? Yep. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Insularity is another one, the degree of social separation from society. And the last one is identity, the degree of self-identification and affinity with the group. So what does this tell us about Mormons, that they exist in different kinds of degrees within the tabernacle?
Well, one way to think about these, one of the goals of our project was to see if we could distinguish. You know, you think of Mormons as being quite homogeneous, and we wanted to think about, well, is there a way to think about describing Mormons internally in terms of their differences? And so we were trying to come up with measures in the surveys that we conducted that allowed us to talk about the ways that Mormons, even active practicing Mormons, can be different from each other. And one thing that's important to mention is that you can be a good active Mormon and be a number of places along these different scales. I mean, it's hard in terms of the activity scale, you're active or you're not.
Yeah.
But in terms of,
after that it breaks down.
But say the authority one that we come up with. One of the questions that I like that we came up with in our survey was, which comes closer to your view? A good Latter-day Saint should obey the Council of Priesthood Leaders without necessarily knowing why, or a good Latter-day Saint should first seek his or her own personal revelation as the motivation to obey. Well, both of those things are very consistent with Mormon theology and doctrine, and so you can be a good active Mormon and agree strongly with either one of those statements. What we're interested in is which statement people agree with more strongly, and then the political implications of that attitude.
And what did you find about authority? Where are most Mormons?
They're more on the authority, obeying church leaders side of the scale.
Is that new? Do you get a sense that that's new? Do you think that Mormons in the 21st century would be more inclined to say, I'm just going to obey? Not blindly, that's a pejorative way of putting it, but that isn't your question, this idea of just not knowing why. So are Mormons today more inclined to be that way, as they might have been in the past, when they would be like, no, I need a little bit more evidence, or I need a little bit more proof or something?
Perhaps the cleanest test of that question, Doug, is how Mormons have responded historically to political messages from church leaders, which are not all that frequent, but there are some cases where church leaders, including the president of the church himself, has come out in favor of a particular position. And Quinn and I have actually published on this and looked at how Mormons have responded to political mobilization, if you will, on the part of the church hierarchy. And it is clear that in the earlier part of the 20th century, that was in that period when maybe Mormons weren't quite as distinctive or were tamping down the distinctiveness, Mormons did not necessarily follow their leader. So quite famously, Mormons actually, or voters in Utah, many of whom were Mormons, voted to overturn prohibition against the counsel of the president of the church. And if we look at other cases where there has been a clear statement on the part of the church regarding politics. The trend has been over the course of the 20th and now into the 21st century that Mormons today are more likely to adhere to what the church is saying than in the past. Now, that's in politics, right? That's not necessarily going to speak to other aspects of life.
But that's your book.
That's perhaps the cleanest test. Yeah. And that there, the evidence is clear. Mormons today are more likely to follow their leaders than in the past.
There's another moving part there, though, and that is that today Mormon church leaders speak in unity with one voice. They don't publicly disagree, whereas in years past, decades past, they did disagree publicly on political matters. They endorsed candidates of both parties. Even in the case of prohibition, the church president had a clear position on the issue, but there were other leaders that disagreed, and I think it was known that they did. And so it made it easier for church members to look at that disagreement and decide which way to go.
Well, you would often see these disputes play out, for example, in the Deseret News editorial pages, like Mark Peterson and Hubie Brown famously used to get into these disputes. You would never see anything like that today. They tend to be perceived anyway as being on the same page.
That's not to say that they don't disagree.
Of course.
It's just to say that
before they go
they don't share that disagreement. When they go public, it's because they agree.
But this is the thing that's I wonder if you put this into the equation at all. You read these, you know, Mormons commenting on blogs or in comment sections, trying to interpret the language that they're hearing in conference talks, for example, to see whether or not everyone is, in fact, on the same page, where one leader may be on this and another may be on that. And they see President Uchtdorf, for example, as representing kind of a softer side of Mormonism on some levels. And, of course, Boyd K. Packer's often talked about as representing the more doctrinaire kind of view, the old guard. Did you see in the studies that you were looking at any reflections of that, people trying to, even though they're publicly unified as a group, looking for distinction still in between the lines, I guess?
Well, the sorts of questions that Quinn was describing earlier on, should you obey your leaders, should you seek personal revelation, are similar to questions we also asked about, say, the role of women in the church, where obviously there's a lot of debate and such right now. And what we find is, while it's by no means a majority of Mormons, there is a sizable minority who actually are more inclined to take what you might think of as the Hubie Brown or the President Uchtdorf position on things. That is, they are sort of looking for the softer side of Mormonism, and so they're a little less likely to embrace the authoritative side of Mormonism, and they're maybe a little less likely to be, as Quinn put it, socially isolated from non-Mormons. And
so you can measure that.
Yes. Now, we want to be clear that when you compare Mormons to other religious groups, they're far more likely, even on the quote unquote liberal end of the Mormon scale, that still makes them far more conservative.
Closer to the center.
Than say Jews or
they're less conservative. How's that?
Yeah, that's right. So, but let's call them Mormon progressives for now.
Sure.
There are lots of names: New Order Mormons who are a little bit further to the left, who think that their leaders tend to be a little bit more fallible, hoping for change within women in the priesthood, gay marriage, those kinds of things. What percent would you say that represents out of Mormonism, that sort of progressive wing? Could you put it into a percentage?
That's difficult to measure because you have to define what it is to be a Mormon. And in our work, what that necessarily means is people that are willing to self-identify as Mormon. And that leaves out, I think, some people that may have hit a point on that progressive scale where they're perhaps unwilling to identify.
Right.
So, but forget that then.
Yeah. So let's stipulate that. So of those who are willing to self-identify as Mormons, how many would you say are quote-unquote progressive? Any idea?
I will give you a back-of-the-envelope guesstimate of about 1 in 5.
I was going to say 15%. So that's
split the difference.
Yeah, not bad.
17.5%. You know, Harry Truman once said that he was looking for a one-armed economist because all his economic advisors kept saying on the one hand, but on the other hand. So
right,
I know it drives you crazy to interview a bunch of academics. But we'll come down. 17.5%. How's that for precision?
Okay, so we need to take a break. But before we move past this part, one of the things you do write about also is that one of the things that will help Mormons get in line with their leaders if there's an official endorsement. that there's an actual official thing that comes down. And one thing that's interesting is you write about, for example, the opposition to the MX missile, which was in the 1980s. Church leaders tried to be really subtle about this early on. They would mention fears about nuclear Holocaust or whatever.
In a Christmas message and an Easter message,
yeah,
of all things.
So they tried it in Christmas. They tried it at Easter. It didn't seem that the body was getting it. And so they went ahead and went all in and made an actual
endorsement. May 1981, there's a pretty lengthy statement issued, and it gets quite specific, opposing the MX missile and sort of announcing that opposition and explaining in a lot of detail why. And I think you see sort of circumstantial evidence, is what we call it in the book, that when you measure opinion a few months later, it has swung the other direction among Utah Mormons in particular.
Does that reflect what the leaders are trying to do? Is they don't want to make an official pronouncement. They'd rather just that people got their point.
Oh, I think it's fair to say that if church leaders can keep themselves out of politics, they would much, much prefer to do so. And I would imagine, I'm of course not privy to these conversations, but I imagine that the deliberations that take place at church headquarters over whether to issue a statement largely rest on whether this particular issue rises to the level that we want to actually take the risk of putting church leaders on record as taking a political stand. Now, in the case of the MX missile, I don't know whether it was actually all that dangerous to do so. I don't think it was too hard to convince people that having nuclear missiles in your backyard maybe wasn't, and therefore becoming the primary target of the Soviets, maybe wasn't such a hard thing to object to. But, you know, these were folks who had voted heavily for Reagan. This was an initiative of the Reagan administration. So obviously there was some persuasion that was needed there.
And that, I guess that's the takeaway in some way. Is it not that for most Mormons, this was an important finding when they had to choose between the political issue or their political ideology and their church? They chose the church.
Yeah, I think that's right for most Mormons. Not right. All, but most. Another good recent example of this is the debate in Utah over immigration, that's since gone a little bit national. But you can see back in 2010, 2011 or so, there's a series of statements that are sort of pro-immigration that talk about treating each other as children of God. It's
compassion,
kind of vague,
yeah.
At first. They progress, and there's a series of them over a very short period of time, just a few months, where by the end, they're naming a bill number in the Utah legislature and saying, not endorsing it, but saying, this bill is consistent with our position. Well, okay. It worked.
Yeah. Quinn Monson is with us. He is professor of political science at teaches political science at Brigham Young University, forgive me, along with John C. Green. They are co-authors of Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics. David Campbell, of course, here, professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. Tonight at 7 o'clock at the City Library in downtown Salt Lake City, David Campbell is delivering the 2014 McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture. It's presented by the University of Utah's Tanner Humanities Center. And I'll also point out tomorrow morning at 11, Campbell and Monson, they're both going to be part of a panel discussing their book at Brigham Young University. All of those details can be found on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another first break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a new book that explores Mormons in the American political landscape. Political scientists David Campbell and Quinn Monson are with us today. They've done a really exhaustive and quantitative analysis of LDS political behavior. Some of their findings are no surprise, but Campbell and Monson are also interested in whether members follow their leaders in political matters and how. The book is called Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics. So one of the things you did was you conducted this kind of experiment where you called self-identified Mormons. And let's see if I get this right. You mentioned to them that the Church First Presidency supported this idea. Now, what do you think about it? Is that essentially how you went about it?
Well, essentially. To add a little bit more detail, the way this works is you have a group of people. These are all Mormons that we've identified using a survey firm, and we randomly assign them. So some, they just are asked their opinion on, say, immigration, or another one we tested was a municipal statute in the city of Salt Lake to ban discrimination against gays and lesbians. So we ask for their opinion. Then we have another group where we give them...
That's the control group, right?
So we did, that's just sort of, okay,
what's your opinion?
What do Mormons think on that question? And then another group, they would get a statement, and I should emphasize that when we do these experiments, everything we ever fed to these folks was an actual statement from the church. We never made anything
up.
But we would give them a statement that we consider to be fairly mild on that issue, and then we would see what their opinion was. And then we had another group where we would give them a statement, again, an actual one from the church leaders, that was more specific on, say, immigration or this anti-discrimination statute. And what we find is Mormons very clearly move dramatically in favor of the church's position on both of those issues. Now, what's interesting about those issues
is the numbers,
especially when it's a specific statement that clearly lays out the church's position on the issue.
So, immigration. If you just as a in the control group, you say, what do you think about immigration generally, or are you what's the percentage and how does it change? Give me a like. I'd be interested to see how that's different.
What you get is roughly a 15 percentage point increase of people moving toward the church's position, which again is a more liberal position on immigration.
Wow.
And what's even more striking about that is you see greater movement among more Orthodox Mormons, the Mormons who are more likely to say that they embrace church authority. Right? They're on the more authoritative side of that spectrum. And of course, what's so intriguing about that is those also happen to be the folks who are more Republican and more politically conservative. So here we have another example of Latter-day Saints putting their church ahead of their party or ahead of their ideology. And some of your listeners may say, well, we would expect that. Well, maybe you'd expect it within the Sacred Tabernacle, within Mormonism, but I assure you that is not the case among other religious groups. When we look elsewhere in the U.S. population, that is exactly reversed, that people are much more likely to put their politics ahead of their religion. But among Mormons, they're distinctive in this way.
Let me add, Doug, that the reason you do this kind of experiment within a survey where you randomly assign people is what we're trying to do is really hone in on whether you can point a finger in terms of causality. We want to know, does the statement by the church cause change in opinion? And when you use these examples like the MX missile or immigration in Utah or Prop 8 or whatever, there's lots of things going on where you could at least say, well, not only on immigration, not only did the church promote this position, but the Utah Compact promoted this position, or any number of other things are happening. In the survey context, when you randomly assign, you get a control group and the other groups that get these statements that are equivalent. You take all of the differences between these individuals and you randomly distribute them to these groups. And the only difference is that one group got the language in their question and the other group didn't. And then you know, since that's the only thing that is different between the groups, you can say that statement caused the change. And that was our goal. So we went through all these case studies to say, we think there might be something here. Historically, it looks like something's going on. Let's pin down whether making a general or a specific statement about church positions on an issue causes change. And it does, very clearly.
You write that Mormons are not monolithic when it comes to their political views. But if such a large number of them are Republican or conservative, how can that be true?
There's different flavors of Republican and conservative.
Okay, but they are on the right.
Yes.
So that's monolithic, isn't it?
Well, but Doug, at the same time, roughly 25% of Mormons are Democrats. Now, that's a lower percentage than it once was.
Sure.
It used to be far more Mormons who are Democrats. And 25% is relatively small, particularly compared to other religious groups. But it does mean that one in four Mormons identifies as a Democrat, not as a Republican. That's a non-trivial number. when it comes to the overall church membership. So we should be careful about terms like monolithic and uniform, even though we don't use them ourselves.
It begins to border on deterministic, which is far from the case.
For sure, but you are seeing the trend is not exactly headed in the Democrats' favor.
Not at all.
In fact, this is one of the more striking things about Mormons as a group. I'm sure it'll come as no surprise to your listeners that among Americans in general, you find young people leaning very heavily toward the Democratic Party, right? The Republican Party, they have a young people problem. Among Mormons, it's exactly the opposite. Young Mormons are more likely
to be... say that again, because that is remarkable.
Young Mormons are more likely to be Republican than old Mormons. And that is exactly the reverse of what you find in the rest of the population. It's a little bit like we're archaeologists and we're sort of able to dig through the remains of what was once a more bipartisan era in Mormonism.
Those are the old Democrats.
Those are the old...
the New Deal guys.
Yeah.
So they, you know, these are people who came of age at a time when it didn't seem all that unusual to be a Mormon and a Democrat. And they could look to people like Hubie Brown, for example, in the first presidency, who was quite openly a Democrat. And that all just seemed fine. Everyone could fit under the big tent. And then over time, the Democrats... well, you didn't find them in large numbers anymore. Either they were leaving or they weren't coming into the church. And today, the young Mormons, they don't put Democrat and Mormon together. They put Republican and Mormon together.
It's important to mention that there's two moving parts here, though. It's as you see this evolution of Mormons becoming more Republican over time, it's not just the emphasis that the church places on social issues that matters. It's also the fact that the political parties take clear and distinctive positions.
So, on social issues.
Yeah. So you don't see the Democrats and Republicans clearly taking positions on abortion until the 1970s. Prior to that time, it's not in their platforms. It's not, and you have plenty of pro-life Democrats and plenty of pro-choice Republicans. It's when they take that clear and opposing position that
that's when the shift happens.
Yeah, well, that's when it...
You say it started right after World War II.
It does, yeah.
It's a really long arc.
It is.
But where it really starts to really...
There's an anti-communist Red Scare kind of effect where you have Mormon leaders being very clearly anti-communist. That extends into the 60s with some of these social issues, into the 70s with abortion, into the 80s and 90s and 2000s with gay marriage. But I wanted to do a bit of a thought exercise, because I think it's clear that in the short term, absent any change, the trend will continue, particularly because these older Mormons will die off and these younger Mormons will replace them as they move through the life cycle. But imagine that if, on the one hand, this partisan divide over social issues diminishes because you get widespread acceptance of legal abortion. Limited but legal abortion. You get more acceptance of gay marriage.
That seems to be happening.
It does seem to be happening. So the parties may start talking about that less, emphasizing that less, and even unifying on that in some odd way that you wouldn't have imagined 15 years ago, right?
But as long as you're talking about social issues, the Dems lose.
Yeah, it's harder, right? But then the other moving part here is what if the church, not changing positions on those social issues, begins to talk more over the pulpit in general conference and other places about things
like... Let's be civil. Like, about Dallin Oaks?
Well, I'm talking more about that, but also something like what Elder Holland gave in general conference last time about caring for the poor. Or if you look carefully on the church's websites, there's not... headlines about sustainability and the environment, but it's there, right? There's a very clear sort of trend about thinking about sustainability. So let's say the parties emphasize social issues less, and the church also emphasizes social issues less, and we see the parties now begin to be at loggerheads over, say, income inequality.
Right.
And at the same time, the church is emphasizing caring for the poor repeatedly at a level that comes up again and again. Well, that could lead over time to...
So you're not ruling it out.
You should never rule it out. Again, I would avoid any kind of thing we say about what is happening and what is likely to happen isn't deterministic,
no, of course.
Right?
But
Doug,
I think, go ahead.
The way I would put it is, as that famous philosopher Yogi Berra once put it, prediction is hard, especially about the future.
Right.
But what Quinn has described is a scenario that, again, I suspect to many listeners seems unbelievable. How could it possibly be that Mormons would shift to the political left? That just doesn't seem possible. Well, it wasn't all that long ago, actually, when that was exactly the case. You know, if you go back far enough, Mormons were almost monolithically Democratic. But, you know, in the mid part of the 20th century, Mormons split their votes pretty readily between the two parties, and it wasn't terribly controversial. So what Quinn is describing isn't outside the realm of possibility.
Not going to happen in 10 years. We're talking, you got to take the long view to imagine that.
I guess a lot of Democrats were putting their hopes into the younger generation. They were sensing among the younger Mormon generation that some support for gay rights, that tends to be a more democratic principle or has been historically, support for women's rights, which tends to be stronger within the Democratic Party. And you're seeing those kinds of social movements, or at least you seem to be seeing that among a younger generation of Mormons. So I think a lot of Democrats would think, oh, that's going to translate into votes potentially. You're saying, you're not seeing that.
Well, it's important, again, to keep our comparisons in mind. So young Mormons are more likely to favor a greater role for women in the church than older Mormons. They're also more likely to be comfortable with at least a civil union type arrangement for same-sex couples, not necessarily endorsement of legal marriage per se. But when you compare young Mormons to young non-Mormons, the differences are still pretty stark. I would actually say that on issues like that, the greater challenge that the church faces is not so much on the political landscape, but actually keeping those young Mormons who do want to see a greater role for women and are perhaps more sympathetic to gay rights, to keeping them in the church.
Right.
Because as Quinn was noting earlier, because especially when it comes to church activity, it's very much you're in or you're out with Mormonism. Clearly, there are those folks who just feel they can't be in, and therefore they're going to be completely out. And other religious groups actually do a better job of accommodating that spectrum of views. You know, I teach at Notre Dame, obviously a Catholic university, and I can assure you that there is a wide spectrum of views within Catholicism on all sorts of hot-button issues in a way that you don't find in Mormonism. And I think it's because it's a lot harder to stop being a Catholic than it is to stop being a Mormon.
Well, there's a lot more to get to when we get back from a break. David Campbell is with us, professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. Quinn Monson teaches political science at Brigham Young University. Along with John C. Green, they're the co-authors of the book Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics. Tonight at 7 o'clock in downtown Salt Lake City, David Campbell is delivering the 2014 McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture. It's presented by the University of Utah's Tanner Humanities Center. Quinn and David will both be part of a panel discussion at Brigham Young University tomorrow at 11. All of the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with David Campbell and Quinn Monson. We're talking about their new book, co-written along with John C. Green. It's called Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics. So I want to ask about, there's a section where you get at the question of how much do Mormons participate in their community outside of church? And, you know, the question always comes up, as you point out in your book, when you're involved as LDS people are in their church duties, do they have time to volunteer outside of the church realm? And even if they did have time, would they see themselves as participating in a community if it didn't mean their own LDS realm? What did you find?
We found that they actually, it doesn't fall off much, except at the very highest end. I mean, Mormons participate in their congregations because they take all the jobs and do all the work. It's a lay clergy. And you see a relationship, actually a positive relationship in particular, between volunteering and engaging in the community and actually the number of hours that you spend on your church work, until you get to the very high end where at some point you actually do run out of time to give. And then part of it also is we wondered, I think fairly, whether all of the reported community activities were church-sponsored or not. Yeah. And in fact, you find a heavy portion of it that comes when people say they volunteer with organizations to assist the poor or elderly, but less so on other aspects in terms of neighborhood or civic groups or school or youth programs or arts and cultural organizations. They're heavily involved in their communities in those types of organizations. And
even if it's outside the church.
Yeah.
You've all heard the saying that if you want something done, ask a busy person. Well, that is really true, and nobody's busier than an active Mormon. And so what we find in the data is actually, for Mormons, what you actually find with other religious groups too, that busy people actually just do more stuff. And that includes, in the case of Mormons, volunteering outside of the church. I know there's a myth, actually, that Mormons concentrate all of their energy within the church, and certainly they put a lot of time and effort into it. But that does not seem to come at the expense of volunteering outside of the confines of the church.
That's interesting because I think that same myth exists when you're talking about studies that show how much money, let me just say, confine it to Utahns, how much money Utahns give to charity each year. And it's always way up there. But then people wonder, if you were to strip out that money that goes to tithing, how much are Utahns actually contributing to charities? The skepticism is that they're just giving to their church, and then their church gives it to the poor, but they're not really engaging with the poor. You're finding is that
there's a correlation between the two, that people that give time at church also give time elsewhere.
I want to move to this question of how, because you write about this, how Americans view Mormons, you know, from the outside. And there's this question that came up a lot when Mitt Romney was running for president. Do the public's attitudes about Mormonism have political consequences? It's essentially, what effect did Romney's Mormonism have on the outcome? What did you find out about that? What did you learn about that that tells you something about the way Americans in general are perceiving Mormonism?
In 2008, Mitt Romney's Mormonism mattered a lot when he was running in the Republican primaries. We ran a series of studies, experiments of the sort we were describing earlier, seeing how people would react when they learned that Romney was a Mormon and had been a local leader in the church. And it's just fascinating to see how negative the response was. In fact, the negativity directed toward Romney's Mormonism matched the negative sentiment directed toward Barack Obama when people learned of the controversial church that he had attended in Chicago, and also to the rumor that Obama is secretly a Muslim. So Romney's Mormon problem, if you will, was as big as the religion problems that Obama
had. The truth that Romney was Mormon is equally powerful as the falsehood, the fiction that Obama is Muslim.
Yeah. Now that was 2008.
Right.
By the time we get to 2012, we see a muting in that negative reaction to, and this is important, to Romney's Mormonism. So the way we conclude our story of the 2012 election in the book is that Mitt Romney's Mormonism mattered a lot to a few people, but probably not enough to sway the election. But it mattered very little or maybe not at all to most voters.
In the general election in particular.
Sure. Here's another question then. It was the question I asked in the introduction. Did Mitt Romney's candidacy have a negative effect on Mormonism? Did that hurt? Because one of the things you say is Mormons involved in politics can lead to a sharper partisan divide about how Mormons are perceived.
Well, that's exactly why I emphasized that the conclusion we draw about 2012 is really specific to Mitt Romney's Mormonism. This is Mitt Romney running against Barack Obama, right? But when you look at just general attitudes toward Mormons, not to Mormon politicians per se, certainly not to Mitt Romney, but just Mormons in general. On the one hand, it looks as though nothing changed. In fact, it's really quite remarkable. The line is flat from about 2006 to really the present. And that's through the Romney candidacy. That's through Book of Mormon, the musical. That's through the I'm a Mormon campaign. that's David Archuleta. I mean, it's Sister Wives. You know, all that stuff did not seem to make a dent in how Americans perceive Mormons. But then when you scratch below the surface and you look at how Republicans perceive Mormons and how Democrats do and how independents do, the story is very different because that flat line disguises what has now become a pretty sharp divide. Back in 2006 when this started, there was no difference between Republicans and Democrats. Basically, they both dislike Mormons equally. Fast forward to the present, Republicans are much more favorable toward Mormons, much warmer toward them. Democrats much less so. independents, as you'd expect, are right in the middle.
Yeah.
And so we've seen this partisan effect that you did not have even 8 years ago.
And we worried about this because our survey that we did came right after the 2012 election. And so we actually fielded one more survey a year later just to see if it was still there, to see if once Romney had faded from the scene, that partisan divide faded. And it hadn't. It was still there.
We're running out of time, but I really want to get to this part because I think it's really, I have to say, this was one of the most fascinating things. You say that suspicions still do remain, of course, Americans toward Mormons. And you say that your findings about social contact are really important here. You say that people who know a Mormon in passing react most negatively to Mormonism. So part of the problem is Mormons only hang out with Mormons, so their relationships with non-Mormons is pretty limited. So talk a little bit about that. And is in essence what you're saying is to Mormons, reach out. Go hang out with people who don't necessarily believe like you.
Certainly that would be the message that that I would share with Mormons, is that reaching out is only to the better. But just to go back to the finding you were describing, yeah, for people who have a Mormon as a close friend or a family member, their reactions to, say, Mitt Romney's Mormonism aren't really affected at all. They've already made up their mind about Mormonism. For those who do not know a Mormon at all, we can actually move their opinions pretty dramatically by telling them things about Mormonism because they don't have any information.
You can counter the negative with positive, right, and move them back where they were.
Wow.
But it's that group in the middle that you just mentioned who know a Mormon in passing. They generally have a negative view of Mormons, and that movement, that opinion doesn't really budge. And our hypothesis as to why that is these are folks who recognize the distinctiveness of Mormonism. They see that this is a group that is the other. They're different in some way, but they don't have that kind of close personal relationship that enables them to overcome any suspicion that just sort of naturally comes along with viewing somebody as different and distinctive.
It's the guy at the office who's Mormon, who you know is Mormon, but that's all you know, and you think he's a little strange because he doesn't go out for drinks after work, but you never really get to know him,
right,
and realize, oh, but
he's a good guy.
He's a great guy, yeah, or whatever. And it's that sort of middle ground where you're aware but not really much else.
I'm going to see if you guys can do this in a minute. Clearly, Mormonism does not want to go back to the early days of separation. So it seems there are a couple of ways forward now for Mormonism. And you talk about there's this new strategy called alignment. Do you want to say something really quickly about that? Because I think this is another really interesting part that say something about that, finally.
Well, by alignment, we mean this is a potential strategy for the church, and that is to align itself politically, basically, with other conservative movements or groups like evangelical Protestants, for example. We actually see great danger in that and don't necessarily consider that to be a healthy path for the church, for the church's own spiritual mission. To get tied up in a partisan perspective is not likely to be helpful for...
But are they headed members. That way?
Not healthy in terms of politics,
no, I know.
Right, to go right. Politically.
In terms of their...
I would say that we are at a point of a critical juncture. I would not say that today Mormons are aligned fully with these other conservative forces in the country, at least not overtly, not politically. It could move in that direction. I don't think it has yet. And my own hope is that it doesn't move in that direction, not because of a partisan perspective on my part, but just because I think that would be completely unhealthy for the church and, frankly, for the sake of religious diversity in America. Whenever religion and politics gets tied up too closely together, negative consequences flow.
What are you hearing, though, from the pulpit? Are you hearing a direction?
That kind of goes back to your earlier point about trying to decipher what church leaders are really saying. It seems to me that this quote-unquote problem or potential problem for the church to be tied up politically with one side of the spectrum does seem to be on the radar screen of church leaders. I think that's why you've heard President Duke Dorsey say some of the things that he said. It's why you certainly hear a letter read over the pulpits of ward meetings regularly reminding church members that it's okay to vote for the other party.
David Campbell, I've gotten completely over time. Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Quinn Monson teaches political science at Brigham Young University. Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing this?
The book is Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons in American Politics. Tonight at 7 o'clock at the City Library, David Campbell is delivering the 2014 McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture. Both David and Quinn are going to be at BYU tomorrow. You can get all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.